Court of Appeals is reconvened. The Honorable Craig H. Nakamura, Daniel R. Foley, and Lawrence M. Reifert presiding. Please be seated. Case number 30295, State of Hawaii v. Miles Jenkins. Timothy McMaster for appellant, Brian Vincent for appellee. Argument on the merits.
Morning, counsel. Ready to proceed?
Yes, sir. Good morning. My name is McMaster. I represent Mr. Jenkins. This is a great case. It's chalk edge. And just a piece of reversible error. I hardly know where to start. I think what I'll do is I will skip the first issue that we raised in our brief. We've already briefed some of the issue about, quite frankly, the issue that we raised with respect to whether or not the charge must specify the essential fact. That's one of the important words. Plain, concise, definite statement of each. You can just hang on those two words. Essential fact. I respectfully submit the essential facts are the facts that they have to prove in order to obtain a conviction. And no one gets convicted in this state of excessive speeding unless they have proven the mens rea. So it's either an essential fact or it's not an essential fact.
Well, why isn't excessive speeding a strict liability offense?
Because there's no mens rea. Because number one, it's a criminal offense. It's not a mere speeding case. Not absolutely appropriate disposition of this case in Santa Olivia.
Is that the only reason? Doesn't the Penal Code indicate that if the legislature intended an offense to be strict liability, it can be strict liability?
Yeah, but that, if you read the commentary on that, that makes it clear that that is the very rare exception. And that, quite frankly, the specific statute 702.204 that says that the statute, like the excessive speeding statute, imposes criminal penalties and subjects people to the moral condemnation.
Right, but isn't the purpose of the statute public safety?
Purpose of the statute is absolutely public safety, but that's the,
doesn't matter
the purpose of every other criminal statute.
But does it matter from the public safety standpoint whether you intend to go over 30 miles an hour or you're actually just going 30 miles an hour?
Yes, it makes an absolute difference, especially if you take a look at the facts in this case. Number one, at first blush, the case that you got a laser reading from the officer saying it was with 75 and a 35. At first blush, it doesn't look like a great case for the defense. But when you take a look at it, and the section of my brief entitled Basic Math explained the mathematical calculations as to why this is basically a case in which there was an alleged 3 seconds at best of excessive speeding. And in the query whether whether there was ever sufficient proof in the evidentiary on this, proof in the evidentiary record on this case, to show that Mr. Jenkins ever had any opportunity to conform his conduct or had fair notice that this was a 35 mile per hour zone coming up. He's tooling along on the H1 freeway. Let this be a cautionary measure to everyone. The one and only thing this court should ever take judicial notice of in this case, quite frankly. The fact that Officer Russ Maishiro likes to sit there at the 35 mile per hour zone.
So you're saying you have 3 seconds after you see a speed limit to slow down? Is that your?
Well, what I'm saying is there was no testimony. The only testimony that there ever was in the evidentiary record in this case with respect to the signs that were present in the area of the alleged offense was that Officer Maishiro could see the signs from his location. There was never any testimony given as to whether the alleged signs in this case were visible from Mr. Jenkins' location or at what point in time they would have been visible to Mr. Jenkins. There's kind of an interesting statute. I didn't quote it in my brief to you, but if you take away 291C31, subsection B, it's entitled Traffic Signs, Signals, and Markings Obedience to and Required Traffic Control Devices. It says no provision of this chapter, which is the chapter 291C105, for which signs are required, shall be enforced against an alleged violator if at the time and place of the alleged violation an official sign is not in a proper position. Corey, what's a proper position? You can dig into that if you want. And sufficiently legible to be seen by an ordinarily observant person. So basically what this says is that we don't penalize you under chapter 291C for violating any kind of a traffic command on a sign or a traffic regulation, which a sign has been posted, unless the state proves that the sign was legible, able to be, you know, at the very least visible. And in this particular case, it's like so much else in this case.
Mr. McMaster,
no evidence.
Can we go back to the charge for a moment where you began?
Yes.
The sufficiency of the charge was not raised below, right?
Yeah, I know.
And
this is my if you'll remember, number one, I was not the trial counsel in this case. I'm appellate counsel. I guarantee you, I raised that issue every time in the trial.
So, given the fact that the sufficiency of the charge was not raised below,
and you're gonna model wells,
Mr. Jenkins has to show prejudice, right?
Well, unless you guys want
so to rule the where is the prejudice? The fact that the charge did not say the violation was intelligent, knowing, or reckless.
I only get 20 minutes here, and so quite frankly, that's not the tree I want to bark up.
Can you tell me the prejudice? Is there prejudice?
The prejudice is that, look, they never did. If unless they have a valid charge, one of my colleagues was saying, you could argue that this charge was void ab initio, because, you know, when you cloak it up in a bunch of Latin, it makes it sound better. The bottom line is, they never had a chain to begin with. All they had were a bunch of broken links. They never got out of the starting block.
But doesn't he have to show prejudice on appeal since he didn't raise it below? Isn't that the law?
Yeah, he does.
And where's the prejudice?
Yeah, okay, so beat me up on that. I reserve that if we don't like your decision here and we have to go argue it in the Supreme Court to argue that they should.
So then you may want to move on to your next point.
I absolutely would like
Let me ask you one more question. Let me ask you one more question on that point. Isn't reckless behavior, isn't a reckless mens rea inherent in the conduct? The conduct charge is going 30 miles over the posted speed limit. Isn't going 30 miles over the speed limit inherently reckless?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
Here's two things. Number one, what all of this is where the legislature, and our job is there again, follow the intent of the legislature, where they have drawn the line between a mere speeding ticket. And it's a cliff. I mean, I love the excessive speeding statutes as a traffic attorney because they cast a broad net. I get people sitting across my desk who never imagined for an instant that they'd be talking to a criminal defense attorney, who never imagined for an instant that their military careers would literally be circling the bullet if they get convicted on this crime, who only thought of themselves as, I'm a good driver, I may drive a little over the speed limit occasionally. That's the way they think of themselves. And half of them, easily half of them, want to tell me, Mr. McMaster, I had no idea I was going over 30, at 39 miles an hour over. I simply had no idea. What I tell them is, well, technically that's a defense. It ought to work on appellate arguments. It ought to work on your bar exam as a practical matter. Don't ever think that you'll ever get a kid. Actually, you guys affirmed one last summer where somebody tried to argue that the evidence in the excessive speeding case had not been sufficient to prove the element of recklessness, right?
We're talking about the charge.
I'm sorry, not the element.
We're talking about the charge.
Mental state of recklessness.
The charge. Isn't it implicit? If you charge someone with going 30 miles over the speed limit, isn't it implicit in that charge conduct that you're alleging someone's acting recklessly?
I like that argument, but no.
Glad you like the argument.
I like good fight. I like good fight, but the answer is no. And the bottom line is, take a look at the way the charge was read in this case. There was no reference whatsoever to any type of mental state. And in fact, the person being read that charge, and look, this is not just. Most of these people who are being read this charge, go down the hallowed halls of the Wyandotte District Court sometime and see what an arraignment is like. You have people coming in off the street in their t-shirts and shorts, etc. And they're being read to the prosecutor on such and such a date in the city and county of Honolulu, you did operate your motor vehicle at a speed in excess of 30 miles, blah, blah, blah. Okay? The only thing they're hearing is you operated the car and you went so fast. And they're thinking, that's all they've got to prove to convict me on this. The only thing they got to prove to convict me, I was driving the car, and I guess I was going that fast. I guess I'm guilty. Now, it takes me 5 to 10 minutes across the desk to explain the whole concept of, do you like that part of my brief where I said, an empty head and a pure heart is an absolute defense in an excessive speeding case. An absolute defense. Because that's pure negligence. You should have known better, but you didn't. You should have known you were going 30 miles an hour, but you didn't. Read that part of my brief where I quoted the commentary that talks about how, you know, the criminal law only imposes the moral condemnation of a criminal penalty. When you've done something, you've had the opportunity to conform your behavior to the requirements of the law, and you have made a conscious decision for which you can be morally condemned. And so, I hear your point. When isn't it implied in the language of the charge? Respectfully submit, no. If you want to decide that yes, that's implied in the language, I don't have a better comeback than to say, when you read it, what was the language that we got used up in Wheeler? It has to be in language that is unmistakable. The persons of common knowledge and understanding. That's the test. They have to plead each essential fact. They got to do it in language that is unmistakable. The persons of common knowledge and understanding. But let's go on to this point here now, because I lose this one eventually in the Supreme Court, because Wheeler was a 40-page decision up there instead of a 4-paragraph decision. I know there were two of the justices up here who never really liked that 4-paragraph decision much, but I loved it. It was absolutely, when the ICA decided Wheeler, and you know exactly what I'm talking about, when the ICA decided Wheeler the first time, that was an analytically tight decision. It was 4 paragraphs. You only needed to write 4 paragraphs. It was an essential fact. It was an essential element. They hadn't said it. But don't say the magic words. You don't get to cast the evil spell. That's the appropriate test. And trust me, there will be plenty of these cases coming. Actually, they're already docketed for you to decide where this issue was raised in a, we'll say, more timely manner. When Mr. McMaster was in charge and raised it at trial, I felt it was worth putting into the brief, because if this does go to the Supreme Court, maybe they will think it over again and take a look and say that 4, but they wrote the 40 paragraphs. They wrote 40 pages for a reason. They're not going to give you this. So let's go on to the foundational stuff, because this is a lot more interesting, quite frankly. They really did not lay a proper foundation for the admission of the laser evidence in this case. Do you have any questions about that?
Why not?
Well, number one, there was not competent testimony in the evidentiary record. There was not properly admissible testimony in the evidentiary record to show that the manufacturer's specifications had been complied with respect to the type of accuracy verification testing that the officer had done.
Your argument on appeal is best evidence rule, correct?
Oh, that's one of the arguments on appeal. Best evidence rule is every time.
Right, but there was no objection on that basis below.
The objection, once again, I wish I'd been the trial counsel on this case, because you'd have a nice, cleaner record for the presentation of these issues. And every law student in this room should know that whenever some witness starts testifying that the writing says this or the writing says that, the proper objection, of course, to make is best evidence rule, because that's the type
of... But if you don't object, don't you waive that argument for appeal?
Well, yeah, that's it. But, you know, every time... The objection
isn't that argument waived?
I guess that would tend to
You didn't argue hearsay in your brief, so didn't you waive it by not arguing hearsay in your brief?
No. I respectfully submit that what we argued. Take a look at what I said. I tried to do the best with what I had to work with there, which were objections that said objection hearsay. I tried to say that this is evidence that clearly violates the best evidence rule. The court shouldn't consider it. And that when the objections were made, hearsay is really basically kind of a permutation of the best evidence rule. And so I respectfully submit that this was not a case where the prosecution laid a proper foundation with properly admissible evidence to show that either one, the officer had been tricked. Now, let's go to the next kind of interesting issue here, too.
Mr. McMaster, before you move on to the next one, as far as the waiver issue, even though the proper objection may not have been made below.
Plain error.
That's right. Plain error, substantial rights of the defendant.
Thank you.
So
thank you.
Can you point out where his substantial rights may have been adversely affected because of this best evidence rule?
He's got a due process right to be convicted upon only evidence which is properly admissible. admissible under the Hawaii rules of evidence.
Right, but if you had objected on best evidence, your best evidence is he should have introduced the manual into evidence.
If you objected
on that basis and the court sustained the objection, couldn't the prosecution just have marked the manual as an exhibit and put it in evidence? So couldn't they have cured the objection by admitting the evidence if you had made the objection?
Oh, bless you. And that is precisely.
Isn't that the reason why we require objections below so that things can be cured if you think there's an error?
Absolutely. I think you're making some really good points on that. If anybody asks you to take untimely requests for judicial notice today, you just keep focusing right along those lines, please. Okay, so in any event, so far you have offered the two best comebacks that I have heard to either of these arguments so far. Now, let's move on to the next one, which was that Officer Miyashiro, the testimony he gave about the training that he received, and the only evidence that ever came into the evidentiary record in this case about what the manufacturer's standards were. And remember, the important date in this case is April 29, 2009. That's the date that the laser, that the LIDAR, that's the term we should all be using from now on. I like that term, LIDAR. That's the term. That's the date that the LIDAR gun was used to get a reading that ended up convicting Mr. Jenkins in this case. And so the issue is, what were the manufacturer's standards for accuracy verification testing on that gun on that date? And do we have any evidence in this evidentiary record whatsoever that shows us what the manufacturer's standards were on that date? And the answer to that is just simply no. Officer Miyashiro, he's a great. He's in our neighborhood cop. My kids love him. He testifies honestly every time he testifies. Everything he said in this particular case, you can take it as if it were gospel. He testified that he was trained in 1994 with the old Marksman laser guns. And he testified he was trained again in 1998 on the LTI ultralights. And unfortunately, that places an 11-year gap between what the hell were the manufacturer's standards during any of that period of time. Is there any evidence in this record whatsoever that shows us whether the manufacturer's standards have changed? And manufacturers constantly change standards, constantly improve equipment. We don't know, as a matter of fact, based on this evidentiary record, whether there are necessarily any changes in the design of the gun or any corresponding changes in the accuracy verification stuff. All of this is stuff we can speculate about, but we're not supposed to speculate. Just a step back, because I'm running out of time here too, probably. This is the way you're supposed to prove an excessive speeding case. In case the law students don't know, what we're dealing with is an excessive speeding statute, which says that basically you can't drive over 30 anywhere in this state, or you can't drive more than 30 miles an hour or more over the posted speed limit. And you better watch it, because this is the cliff you fall off of from being just a regular speeder into the moral condemnation of society and being a criminal. And the penalties are extremely harsh. Mr. McMaster fights every excessive speed case, never plead guilty to it, because the judge never gives you anything more than a minimum penalty, because it's harsh enough. And so in this particular case, The prosecution tried to prove that Mr. Jenkins was operating his motor vehicle because the laser reading.
Counsel, you're arguing to us.
It's only 75. They tried to prove that that Mr. Jenkins was going 30 miles an hour over the speed limit as stated on official signs posted by the director of the Department of Transportation on highways under the jurisdiction of the director. Now, the first thing you have to prove in an excessive speeding case is where it allegedly happened. Did it happen on a county road, a county highway, or did it happen on a state highway? Because never the twain shall meet. Statutorily, they are entirely different. And if you're trying to prove what the speed limit was on a county road, well, the county road is the only place that you can actually get that reference according to the statutory definition of applicable state or county speed limit is from a county ordinance. They're called county speed schedules. The city council adopts ordinances that says the speed on this particular location, this particular county highway, shall be 35 miles per hour. Now, on a state highway, however, the only way that you, speed schedules are entirely irrelevant if you're on the, if there was ever any evidence in the case that the H1 freeway was a state highway. Perhaps this might even be something that if you want to take judicial notice of, you can take judicial notice if H1 freeway is a state highway. So the way that they had to try to prove this case was to show that there were official signs placed by the director of the Department of Transportation on a highway under the jurisdiction of the director. So that's it for me.
Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm going to do this to the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Brian Vincent, of the state of Hawaii. I'm not going to spend very much time on the charging issue either.
Let me ask the first question I asked then. Do you concede that excessive speeding is not a strict liability offense?
I didn't argue that on my brief, and I'm not going to argue that here. I suspect that you're going to find that it's a reckless. And one of the reasons why I suspect that is because there's a couple of cases I didn't cite in my brief, and I wish I should have. So I apologize for that. One was a state McDowell, that's 66 Hawaii 650. The other one's a state Connie, that's 3 Hawaii Ave 450. And those involve the possession of firearm charge. And like here, there was no state of mind involved in that statute, right? Or it was not specifically stated in the statute, right? The Hawaii Supreme Court and the ICA found in each case that the applicable state of mind was reckless. I suppose there might be an argument this speeding statute is strict liability. I suspect you're not going to find that. Steve McDowell and Connie also refused to reverse the conviction based on the fact that the state of mind of reckless was not stated.
Let me ask you this. You, if you're conceding that it's not a strict liability offense, then you do have to prove at least recklessness to convict, correct?
You have to prove
a state of mind.
That's right.
But why doesn't the state charge it? And what's the downside of charging the mens rea when you have to prove it?
I agree, and I think we're moving. I think our office is moving in that direction. Okay. So we've started identifying some of the cases where the state of mind has not been included in the charge. And we're putting it in. Okay. Again, the Model Wells Little Construction Rule says that unless the defendant can show prejudice, the conviction will not be reversed with the indictment's challenge only after conviction. Unless the indictment cannot, within reason, be construed to change charge of crime. And the defendant has not argued prejudice, and I think that the statute as it reads can be construed by a reasonable person to charge a crime to the extent of just to establish the court's jurisdiction. Okay, so I'll just move to the next issue. The $500 question here. That's what he was fined for getting speeding, excessive speeding meters, plus court costs. Is there sufficient foundation here? Okay. I argued that there was evidence in that case. There was an inference in that case. That it was the manufacturer's recommended procedures. They didn't agree with me. I think this case is much different though. I would just point your attention to the testimony in the transcripts. The DPA asked Officer Maya Shiro, okay, did you have an opportunity to review the manual for the electronic trauma? Yes, sir. Do you know who created that manual? Well, it's marked LTI or Laser Technologies Incorporated in the front.
Why isn't that hearsay?
I'll skip ahead of that. And I know what the transcripts say.
I know you cited some. Your argument is that it's copyrighted by the manufacturer, and that's why the manual was made by the manufacturer. But is there any case that says that you can use the copyright of a manual to establish who the author of the manual is?
Why rule? Let me just go straight to the hearsay.
Right.
And just address that. I don't believe it's been raised on appeal correctly. I don't believe it's been argued on appeal, and therefore this court may disregard that point of error. Okay. With respect to the hearsay objection made on appeal, or made, which was made at the trial court but was not argued on appeal. Okay. But first of all, I would argue that under Rule 104, the rules of evidence do not apply. Okay? The judge is not confined to the rules of evidence. Okay.
You're saying they can establish who the author of the manual was by hearsay.
That's correct. In a foundational matter, right? The commentary to Rule HRE.
Does the Supreme Court say that too?
This issue hasn't, as far as I can tell, it hasn't. This is the issue of first impression. This is what the commentary to Rule HRE Rule 104 specifically says. But the judge should be empowered to hear any relevant evidence, such as affidavits, or other reliable hearsay. Okay, and also as arguing.
So what's reliable about an officer's testimony that this manual that he read was produced by the manufacturer of the laser gun?
Well, first of all, the credibility. First of all, officers on the stand, his credibility can be tested with respect to did he see what he said he saw. Okay. I would also bring to your attention, before trial, the trial attorney obtained this order regarding production of the Laser Technology Incorporated manuals. Okay. They received four different manuals, one of which was the ultralight user manual. Okay. So clearly, they had the opportunity.
So you're saying it was disclosed in discovery?
It was disclosed in discovery. They got an order to peruse it and also make one copy of that. And they could have used that on cross-examination to cross-examine Officer Maeshira as to whether or not the test that he described very thoroughly in his testimony were actually tests that were recommended by the manufacturer in the user's manual.
Right, but before you get to that, you still have the burden of production as to the foundational requirements for the laser gun, right? I mean,
that's
fact that they can cross-examine you doesn't mean that you win.
That's correct. But the officer testified that he had, and he testified specifically, and was your training based on the manufacturer's specification as designated in that manual? And after the hearsay objection, he says, yes, it was. Yes, sir. Okay. And then somewhere at the end here.
But we're still back to the question. Why isn't that testimony hearsay?
Well,
the testimony that, for the truth of the matter, that this manual was a manual produced by the manufacturer of the laser gun.
Well, first of all, I would argue it's not introduced for the truth of the matter asserted. Okay. The recommended procedures or imperatives.
No, okay, I agree. The contents of the manual is not for the truth of the matter asserted, but who is the author or the originator of the manual? Isn't that for the truth?
Okay, there's two levels. First of all, is the manual an official manual? Okay, and then second of all, are the procedures in the manual?
Right. He could testify. I read the manual and I did what the manual said. That wouldn't be hearsay because it's not. You're not offering the contents of the manual for the truth. You're just offering it for the fact that he read it and he did what it said.
That's correct.
But the first question is, one of the requirements of SIA is you have to show that you followed the manufacturer's recommendations. So it seems like one of the critical predicates is you have to show that the manual that you followed is the manufacturer's manual.
That's correct. And as I pointed out, the Hawaii Rules of Evidence provide for self-authenticating documents. Okay, it describes trade inscriptions and the like, simply noting that the circumstantial evidence of authenticity of such evidence is great. So, this is the same copy that the defendant has, And defendant trial attorney had it, the appellate attorney has it. It's made available to defense attorneys pursuant to this order, okay, to any attorney that asks for an order. It's also, LTI also provided copies of this to the district court. Several, I understand, well, I talked to Judge Richardson, and several copies were sent to her. So this is widely known, okay?
Is there any reason why it's not offered into evidence?
Your Honor, I'm not saying that it was...
I'm not saying it should or shouldn't be.
I'm not saying it was the best practice not to offer it into evidence, if I would have been the trial attorney, I would have asked for the district court to take judicial notice of it at the trial level. That would be my solution to the problem if I was trial attorney. I think this is judicially noticeable, okay? And in fact, if you're curious what it says, I can provide it to you right now and ask you to take judicial notice.
It's not in the record, right?
It's not, Your Honor. But Rule 201. Well, let me just quote from Williams v. Theonos. It's a case came out in 2009, a Supreme Court case. You know, this is rule, this is 121 Hawaii 1, page 12, footnote 6. Okay? Hawaii Rules of Evidence provides that judicial notice can be taken of facts capable of accurate and ready determination by resort to sources whose accuracy cannot reasonably be questioned, and that the court may take judicial notice, whether requested or not, at any stage of the proceeding. Indeed, the trial court may take judicial notice of a fact if it is common knowledge or easily verifiable. Additionally, an appellate court is not precluded from exercising its discretion to take judicial notice of certain facts where the trial court elected not to do so. As we see it, the purpose of the judicial notice rule, it would appear to be a wholesome one, is to eliminate the necessity of taking the time of the court and jury to make formal proof of a fact which cannot be disputed. In this case, in Williams v. Iowa, there was a collective bargaining agreement that had been attached to the, one of the briefs in the to the ICA.
I think it was on a website. It was on their official website, right?
That's
why they took judicial notice.
I think it was, well, yeah, maybe. It was attached as Exhibit B to one of the briefs. Okay. They took judicial notice. Then the Supreme Court took judicial notice of it, even though the ICA was silent as whether it was going to take judicial notice or not. I would just ask, if you're amenable, to just take the manual. Take a look.
Is that on their website?
No, this is not available on the website. LTI charges attorneys $100 for each manual. Okay. So it's.
All right. So let me see if I understand your. So your argument is that you can use hearsay to lay the foundation, and you're saying that.
That's correct.
The officer can testify because he can look at that book and it says ultralight, and he can look at it and it says it's copyrighted by laser technology, and then he can say, by hearsay, yeah, I know that book was produced by the manufacturer of the laser gun.
It also has the manufacturer's logo. If you check on the website, same logo is on the website.
And that's the reliability of the hearsay. In other words, he's looking at the book, which looks to be, appears to be, is a manual by the manufacturer. So based on that, he can testify on hearsay that is the manufacturer's book.
At trial, the state has to prove by preponderance of the evidence that the speed reading, which is what we actually want to get in, is reliable. We have to prove it by preponderance of evidence.
Okay. Well, what's your argument as to your opponent's argument that the only evidence that was presented was that he was trained on a 11-year-old manual, not the manual for the device that he used?
He was specifically. Well, first of all, and then that's another thing, is if you look at this, this is the same manual that he has, the same manual the district court has. This is a copyrighted 1997, okay? I don't think there has been any new manuals, okay? Even if there was new manuals, I would strongly argue that this is the same ultralight gun that's been used for the last... since they started producing the gun. There's no changes in the manufacturer recommended procedures. I don't think we don't have to prove, prove that. I think unless the defendant challenges that it's not, you know, provides some sort of evidence that this is not the applicable manual, I don't see how this court can just ignore Officer Maestro's testimony as to whether or not, you know, he had consulted the manual, as to whether or not he was trained correctly. That's our position, Your Honor. Did you have any further questions on that? I guess I covered everything. This evidence was not raised at trial.
One thing that goes back to Judge Nakamura's question to Mr. McMaster is on the purpose of objecting below, why we have this rule that you have to make a specific objection below. Mm-hmm. So the judge or the opposing counsel has the opportunity to address it. And best evidence wasn't raised below.
That's correct.
But had it raised below, then, of course, the state could have offered the manual, right?
That's correct. That's correct. And our argument is that there's no plain error here. I think there's no injustice to the substantial
rights.
this court has said that when an objection is made, it will be taken for that, you know, it's for that reason and for no others.
I have one question for you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. McMaster referred to taking judicial notice that H-1 freeway is a state highway.
That's correct.
But can we take judicial notice for sufficiency purposes where the trial court didn't take judicial notice?
Yes, Your Honor. I would just argue that the court made the right decision, didn't articulate the right decision.
But did you answer my question? My question is, I know that each court can take judicial notice of commonly, widely accepted facts, but for purposes of establishing sufficiency of the evidence, can an appellate court take judicial notice of a fact that was not judicially noticed by the trial court? Now, the trial court is a finder of fact. Can we take judicial notice to fill in gaps when the trial judge didn't himself or herself say, I'm taking judicial notice of this?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that this court did in Williams v. Iowa, the case I said earlier, and that took judicial notice of it.
Right, but that's not a sufficiency claim.
They've done it in cases where I think they took judicial notice of the fact that the Waikiki is in the city of Kaipaulu, which is necessary.
Even though the trial court didn't.
That's correct. I can set you the case real quick. Various things like that, jurisdictional issue, things that they take judicial notice. Do we have to prove a trial? They take judicial notice. So.
Another question I had is, for the recklessness state of mind, does the state have to not only prove that, in proving this case, does the state have to prove that the defendant was reckless in driving more than 30 miles an hour over the speed limit? In other words, not just prove that they were reckless in driving, but reckless as to the specific understanding that the defendant himself was going more than 30 miles an hour over the speed limit.
The state has to prove that the defendant was reckless as to whether or not he had to have endured a substantial and justifiable risk as to whether he was driving 30 miles an hour over the speed limit. Right. It doesn't have to be reckless in the sense that he was almost hitting other cars or...
Right. So in this case, he's what, 5 miles an hour? He's 75. He's 5 miles an hour. How many miles an hour over 30 is he?
He was 40 over. So he's 10 miles an hour over the 30 mile.
And is a proof of recklessness simply the fact that he was 10 miles over the 30? You know, he was driving 40, so he must have been reckless as to the 30.
Our argument was he was going 20 miles an hour over even on that stretch of the highway where it's 55. That had to have put him on notice that he needed to be very carefully watching the speed limit signs. When he entered the 35 mile an hour zone, he ignored a substantial and justifiable risk that the speed limit might drop down precipitately. With respect to the the state and state highway. There's, I know that the defendant has conceded that it is a state highway, and we acknowledge that Officer Meischer misspoke when he said that the signs were city and county signs. Okay, but that is not correct. They were not city and county signs. Okay? But what happened was, and I would ask the court to look at page 23 of the transcripts. It says, okay, so DPA says, may I approach? Okay, officer, are you familiar with the speed schedule? Yes, sir. Your Honor, may I approach? Yes, you may. Officer, this is the speed schedule. Can you find the area in question? It's on page 1. Okay, H1 freeway in the vicinity of the Middle Street overpass, specifically by mile marker post 18.45 and 18.72 in that general area. Go ahead, man. Okay. And Your Honor, for the record, I'm showing defense counsel the specific area in question, the Middle Street overpass, and Cocoa Head bound 35. Yes, Your Honor. This is the defense counsel. Yes, Your Honor. I have seen the speed schedule, and I have no objection to it. Okay, then. You'll take judicial notice? The court says yes, you'll take judicial notice. The schedule that they're talking about is...
It would help if they put the schedule in evidence. Make it easier for us if you put it in.
It's over in there on the bench in the traffic court in Alakia Street. And I suspect that there's probably likely the same copy here in the well in the Supreme Court library, right?
But it'd be easier for us if it was in the record as an exhibit.
Yes, but this court is pursuant to State v. West, okay? Which is 95 OY 22, holds that district courts are duty bound to take judicial notice of official traffic speed schedules pursuant to HRA Rule 202B. Okay, so we don't have to.
So you're saying that the fact that it's a state highway is in that speed schedule.
That's correct. Yeah, this is what it's titled. It's called Oahu Speed Limit Inventory State Highways, April 20, 2008, certified by an official from the State of Hawaii Department of Transportation Highways Division, and the and it's kept at the bench at the various traffic court judges. Okay. So, Your Honor. The state, the district court, and the defendant, they were all literally on the same page, okay, with respect to whether this was a state highway, okay? Furthermore, HRS 291C31C provides that whenever official traffic control devices are placed in position approximately conforming to law, such devices shall be presumed to have been so placed by the official act or direction of lawful authority, unless the contrary shall be established by competent evidence. And this court in State v. Vallejo held that presumption was not an unconstitutional presumption. So it's clear this was a state highway, and there's a presumption that this was a state sign. There was no evidence that it was to the contrary, that this was not a state sign. I don't think that the district court erred in finding that it was a violation of the state zone. Exceeding the speed of the state highway. One issue that defense counsel didn't touch on here today is he makes an argument that there was no margin of error ever indicated for the speed gun. Okay? And again, Your Honor, I apologize, but this is online, okay? And U.S. Department of Transportation, National Highways Traffic Safety Administration, has a speed measuring device performance specification for the LIDAR models. Yeah. They prepare those in conjunction with the International Association of Chiefs of Police, and they produce a conforming product list. Okay. As I said, both of these are available online. If you look at the laser section, part 2 of the conforming product list, you see that all the models of the LTI laser gun are listed as being a conforming model according to the NHTSA performance specifications. And the performance specifications say that the gun has to be accurate to within +1 mph or -2 mph. So in this case, we're well over that. We're at least 10 miles an hour with a 30 mile an hour excessive speeding limit.
It's close though.
Okay. So we would argue that this court can take judicial notice of the fact that the performance specification, defendant uses margin of error in his brief, and I would believe that a more accurate term would be accuracy specification, okay, established by the manufacturer. If you look at the manual, they say plus minus one, five minus one, okay? There's no doubt, and this is considerably more than 30 miles an hour over. Okay? I made copies of the thing that's made on the internet. If you want a copy or if you want the website?
Wait, sit down. It's not your turn.
No.
Okay, if you don't want it, do you think we would submit the evidence on the record is...
If you want to submit it, do it formally in some kind of pleading, but not...
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry, Your Honor. There is a provision for submitting cases that have been decided after you submitted your brief, but I didn't see anything on the record that would provide me the authority to just send you this and ask you to take additional notice of it. I should have done it in my answering brief. I didn't apologize. Again, I think we discussed earlier that as with respect to whether or not he had a record state of mind as to whether or not he was traveling 30 miles an hour over the speed limit, and I believe that he did have a record state of mind. As to, you know, he should have been aware. He should have been paying attention to the speed limit signs. He should have. And he didn't speak more. Do you have any more questions?
No. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for listening.
A brief rebuttal here. The reason I was jumping to my feet was to make an objection that Mr. Vincent didn't just spring all this NHTSA stuff on me. He had been kind enough to email me last week to say that he was planning to ask, quoted the Otlona case, and said that he was going to ask the court to take judicial notice, the ICA, to take judicial notice of the speed measuring device performance specifications LIDAR module from NHTSA, which until he put these in my hand, God bless him, I had never seen these before. And he had also told me he wanted to take judicial notice of the laser manual. I was going to object to that. This order that he's referring to is actually not just an order that says that they have to give up the laser manual. It's also a protective order that says that you can't distribute the manual, et cetera, et cetera. It limits what the attorney is allowed to do with the manual. When he referred to the manual being sold to attorneys for $100, he was referring to the manner in which I got my copy of the manual, which is I had to give my credit card to LTI, and they charged me $100 to get a copy of the manual. Now, the question whether any of that would be proper in terms of ready resort to the 201D test for judicial notice of an adjudicative fact. And also, just the fact that if you take judicial notice of anything at this late stage of the game, that's why when you were hammering on me about if there had been a timely objection, best evidence rule, then they could have changed their trial strategy to accommodate the objection that they made. Well, certainly, they've been asking the court to take judicial notice of things like this down at the trial level. Mr. Barbie, the trial attorney, probably would have modified his defense strategy as well. So for all the reasons I said to Mr. Vincent in the... And the other document he had mentioned, too, was this standards he referred to from the International Association of Chiefs of Police. Now, please understand how any accused criminal defendant might think that an organization composed entirely of current and retired chiefs of police might be an organization that whose accuracy might be, or biases might be somewhat questionable to begin with from the defense perspective. So respectfully submit, bottom line is none of this stuff meets the test for the manual does not meet the test for taking judicial notice, especially not this litigation due to the IACP stuff. It certainly does not meet it. This is nothing whatsoever like the document, the collective bargaining agreement that was an actual governmental contract, is a public document, public record, easily accessible. And, anybody could get a hold of it. It's up on a website, apparently, too. That's the first I've heard of that. Well, I'll tell you one thing that is up on a website, and it's also a government document. And if you want, when I got this stuff, I was as happy as a pig in a pile of mud. And I just started to wallow in this stuff. And if anyone wants to take judicial notice of this stuff and get out and wallow in it with me, then by all means, please, I invite you to. Take a look at the section 5.4 of this, if you're going to take judicial notice. Incidentally, we would have no objection to you taking judicial notice of these. These seem to be the 2004 standards published by NHTSA for speed measuring device performance specifications for LiDAR modules. The two tests that were done in this case to test the accuracy of the gun on April 29, 2009 were an alleged delta distance test and a scope alignment test. Section 5.4 deals with range accuracy. They're supposed to have, I've never known this, they're supposed to have two baselines that are measured out, and one of the baselines is supposed to be at least 300 feet long. In all my experience as a trial attorney, I never once heard an officer give testimony that would come anywhere near close to conforming to these NHTSA regulations. So by all means, if you want to take judicial notice of this stuff, footnote 3 in State versus Ito. I don't know how much of that ever made it into anybody's brief, but that made it into the Ito case. I have gotten more mileage out of that footnote as a defense attorney in DUI cases than mopeds get out of a gallon of gas. Please, wallowing these, quote them all in explicit detail into your opinion for this case, because they don't do anything even close. The target shall be checked using two measured baselines. This is for the delta distance.
Counsel, what are you rebutting?
Well, I'm rebutting any reference whatsoever that these NHTSA standards support anything that the prosecution has to say, because they just absolutely beat them over the head with a baseball bat. In this particular case, Russ's testimony, you can take a look at it on page 13 at lines 24-25, was there were two distances. He measured them himself. The first one was 89 feet, the second one was 75 feet. Well, normally when they're shooting the laser gun, I mean, they're shooting them at a long distance. One of the reasons, obviously, for having one of the baselines to measure the delta distance test at least 300 feet is to get some sort of common sense. Tells us that it would be to get some sort of an idea of how the gun is performing at longer distances. Russ only shot at 79 feet, at 75 feet, 85 feet. This is a clear violation of the NHTSA standard.
That's not the manufacturer's recommendation.
No.
Sias is manufacturer's recommendation.
Right, Sias is manufacturer's recommendations too. But in Sias, there was never any argument about NHTSA standards or consideration of NHTSA standards. And for the same reason,
don't we have to follow the Supreme Court?
I think you do, but for the same reason that cases we follow the NHTSA standards for the administration interpretation of field sobriety tests in DUI cases, for the exact same reasons, these would seem to be reasonable standards for LiDAR detection devices, for LiDAR speed detection devices. So bottom line is I was told by the prosecution, hey, we're going to ask for this for judicial notice. That's why I salted those little hints into my first batch of time. Okay, now the other thing, you had a great point, which is there was no evidence in the evidentiary record here that this was the manual that the officer had any personal knowledge that this was, in fact, the manual that. I wrote down what the prosecutor was saying here, too, as he was talking. He said, I don't think there are any new manuals. Even if there were, I don't think that. We don't know whether there are any. He was going to ask you to take judicial notice of the manual that was made back in 1998. He doesn't know whether there are any new manuals and can't represent it. So, is that anything you can take judicial notice of? Really? The NHTSA standards are governmental publications. They're like that contract, they're not ONA. I'm not asking you to take judicial notice of them here, but if any of you want to, go right ahead. Bottom line is, and also that inherent measure, he had mentioned the argument we've made, I had addressed in my opening remarks, but the inherent margin of error. The DiBenedetto case is an interesting one. I love DiBenedetto. I never leave home without it because of the present recollection. I turned it into a verb, DiBenedetto, the witness. But the second half of that case is also quite interesting. And that's the one that dealt with the jury instruction in the DUI case that said that prosecution had to prove that the test result was at least a 0.11 back when the standard was 1.0 because you applied the inherent margin of error as well. So in this particular case, there was never any evidence deduced as to what the inherent margin of error was for this particular measuring device. It's an electronic device for measuring speed. It's just like an electronic device for measuring breath. Any further questions or data?
That's it. Thank you. Take the case under advisement.
All right. Court is now adjourned.
Now. Right there, that's what you're starting at. If by definition, you're driving 40 over the posted speed limit.
I think there's a 45 on the speed on the 5 or 6.
After the
rules are testified for trial.
I think traditional notice that's where Russ likes to use.